Welcome to season two, episode one of 115 Miles. Josh, we're back.
We are back.
Thanks for that.
In form as ever, clearly.
Yeah, in flow, simpatico. Listen, great conversation today. What was the highlight for you?
I really enjoyed talking about the whole mental health day from work. I thought that's a really good conversation because, like we always do, we didn't just, hopefully, we didn't just polarize one way. We actually went in and tried to split the hairs and say, what's the real conversation here? And I found myself uncomfortable exploring it. And I know when I feel uncomfortable, we're in the territory that we want to be in. What was your favorite bit, Haz?
I think my favourite bit was talking about espresso versus espresso and that you're a coffee snob. No, seriously, I think, you know, we had a very good conversation around immigration and how we view that in this country. We talked about the rising, I guess, epidemic. In some quarters, people may see the epidemic around stress and pressure. It was a really good conversation. What should people do, Josh, if they need to find us?
They should come and get us at 115 Miles Pod on Instagram. Look out for loads of content coming your way with season two. And they should also leave us a review, preferably a good one, but leave us a bad one if you want. Just leave us a review on the platform that you listen to us on, and we'll see you again in the next episode. This is 115 Miles with Josh Connolly and Hassan Kaya. Growing up 115 miles apart, our lives couldn't have been more different. But we find ourselves today with many similarities and outlooks upon life. Join us on our podcast as we take a topical dive into life, work, culture, and everything in between.
Josh!
Yes, Hass!
Welcome back. Welcome back after the summer. First things first, is this season two or is this season one continued?
I believe we should call it season two, and I'll tell you why we should call it season two. And that is because I forgot what number we were on episode of the last one. So now we can start again and go season two, episode one.
Oh, like it. I'd forgotten too. I think we did something like 32, 31, 32, but professionals would have checked that before they came on and started recording, right?
Listen, mate, we're not about numbers. We're about top quality content.
Quality, not quantity.
Top, yeah, exactly. Exactly that. But it's good to be back, mate. And I feel energized again by 115 miles. So I'm looking forward to this show and the rest of the ones that are coming up.
Back by popular demand or five people. We know at least five people have asked us to bring it back.
But. Well, I got stopped in town. Shout out James, who I saw in town, who stopped me, who I haven't seen for a number of years since I left my old job. And we said hello, talked about his wedding that he's just had. So happy marriage day. And then he brought up the podcast and was like, you better make sure that you bring it back, and said that he was going to text me. So I think it was that kicked our ass into gear.
Yeah, we were sort of umming and ahhing about it, and it was that chance reunion that just got us back into it. So yes. That's good.
Cheers, so here we are, James.
Yeah, nice one. So when we were testing the sound earlier, you said what you had for breakfast. What did you have for breakfast today, Josh?
I had a protein coffee.
What goes into a protein coffee?
Protein.
Just what, coffee?
No, I make a black coffee and then I put a scoop of protein powder in it and I shake it up in a shaker and then I have it.
Instant coffee or like the good stuff?
No, the good stuff, mate. Come on.
Ah, do you ever drink instant coffee?
No. I mean, look, if I came around your house and you offered it to me, I wouldn't turn my nose up and say I'm not having it.
But inside you'd be dying, would you?
But inside I'd just think, he is everything I knew he was.
So you're a bit of a snob? Coffee-wise?
Mine's an espresso. That's what I have.
When you were younger, as you were moving into this more middle class phase, did you used to call it espresso? You did, didn't you? You yeah. did. Yeah. Everyone goes through that journey.
When you were moving into this more middle class phase.
Yeah. Yeah. We know about the early days. You know, you've talked a lot about your early days, Josh. But yeah, but you know when you used to drink instant coffee, right? With yeah. probably about 8 spoons of sugar. I bet you were an 8 spoons of sugar kind of guy back in the day.
No, I've never been a big sugar in coffee person, though.
Okay, well, but when you went from instant to brewing,
yeah,
you used to go espresso.
Espresso, yeah. And then I moved, yeah. And then I went, because I used to, well, first I bought a cafetiere, and then I would have that, and then I started having them black. And then I'm on double espresso now. I bought an espresso machine. So I have used the pods and that, yeah.
So you're not a fan of frothy, milky coffees or?
Not anymore. I used to be a skinny latte guy.
With your avocado and toast. With my avocado. That was your Instagram highlight whenever you were in town. Anyway. Yeah. So that's nice. You had a protein coffee. I'm just having straight up coffee, no protein.
Instant. I bet it's instant, isn't it?
It's not actually. It's not. But I do like an instant. I have to say, I think I like to mix it up.
Oh yeah.
Reconnect with my roots.
Yeah, I was going to say. Unlike you. Yeah. No, I've left all that behind now. I'm way better than the person I used to be.
That is true. That is true, except in fantasy football. But it's too early to talk about your fantasy football performance at the moment. But what has been happening over the summer, Josh? Give us a quick 30-second highlight reel.
My summer in 30 seconds was that naturally my work goes quite quiet. So rather than worry too much about that, I took loads of time off, did loads of days out. Shout out my wife who just booked loads of things in the diary. And then I blocked them out on my diary. And we did loads of things with the kids, went loads of different places, finished by taking all 6 of my children to Wembley for the Andorra game. That was like the last hurrah of the summer holidays. It's been really focused on family, exactly why we took time off. I actually went out and did it. And it was, one of the most amazing summer holidays, I think, I've ever had. That's my summer holidays in 30 seconds, Has. Give me yours in 30 seconds.
Running around after a puppy.
No, yeah.
I don't need 30 seconds, mate. I basically got a puppy. I can't even remember if I'd got the puppy when we finished. I probably just got the puppy as we were wrapping up season one. It's just been about getting used to canine in the house, and it's been really incredible fun. She's like amazing, good fun and a good laugh, and had a little week away, which is my first week off this year, so as the saying goes, I think the cobbler has the worst shoes around or something like that, and I think as a coach I'm really bad at taking time off, so it's really good to do that. And yeah, back into it.
Lots of stuff going on. I like the saying, the cobbler has the worst shoes around.
I don't think that is the exact saying, but I think that's the sentiment of the saying.
Yeah, I never heard that one before. Love a good saying.
Yeah. Well, we're full of them, aren't we? And what is on the horizon for you as you look at the next few months in terms of work and what you're up to?
Well, I launched my 6 weeks in a U program. So we're in week 2 of that at the moment. We've got just over 50 people on that every week. There's a live session. So that's been brilliant. I've been fully immersed in that, really, really enjoying that. Lots of corporate work coming up in person, online. So that's keeping me really busy. Holiday booked to Jamaica, still booked to Jamaica. That's a roller coaster ride as to whether that's going to happen or not. But keeping my fingers crossed for that. That's the horizon, mate. Doing as much learning as I can as well. I've really sort of upped my learning game since I did the breathwork training at the beginning of the year and the impact that's had on me. I've just made sure that I'm going back to learning, trying to learn more all the time. So, that's me.
Yeah, I think I'm definitely going through that same journey around learning, but I think what I'm realizing is that you have to make time for it. You can't just try and fit it into when you get a little gap, because that gap will always be filled by something else. And so you just kind of keep putting it off. So you have to prioritize learning, because it just, it kind of moves you forward.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
The one thing I would say very quickly about my work is, we sort of joke about the kind of moving into the middle class and all that kind of stuff. You know, the big conversation around, can money buy you happiness and that kind of thing, right? As somebody who, we didn't have anything, right? We didn't live a bad life, me and my wife, when I was in my old job. But I don't know if I've talked about it on here before, but if we wanted a bag of protein for the month, that was the one treat for the month. And then everything else went pretty much on bills, as well as allowing like a day out here and there each month with the kids, a day out that was paid for that wasn't walking the dog. As things have sort of like improved in my life with the work that I do, being able to, if there's no work in on a Thursday or whatever, take, you know, not really do any work and go and walk the kids to school, pick the kids up from school, and then maybe go and grab something to eat somewhere after school, has had a huge impact on my life, and a really positive one. Do you know what I mean? So,
yeah,
like we talk that conversation around money and can it buy happiness. I'm not saying that it can, but I do now recognize the people that find themselves in sort of relative poverty and in them spaces, their chances of that kind of freedom that I now have are much slimmer, right? So when we talk about mental health and people's emotional state and stuff like that, it, you know, it is driven so much by the environment in which you exist in and what that looks like.
Yeah, it's a big topic, and because I think you could probably look at the people that say money can't buy you happiness, and they probably have money or some element of it, and I think it, maybe money doesn't buy you happiness, but a lack of money can cause unhappiness.
Yeah,
right? because it shifts the way you. You know, the way you get opportunities, like you say, but also if you don't have money, then you may have to take two jobs or three jobs, you know, or whatever. And, you know, so it does impact.
Yeah. Within the framework of life that we live in the structures that we exist in and operate in as people, it does play a part in it. It doesn't, like, you, I'm not saying you get loads of money and it's going to make you really happy, right? There's, it brings with it other struggles as well and all that sort of stuff. But to quote Akala, he says,
did you just like just check in with me to make sure I knew who it was? Yeah. But maybe not everyone does. So
Akala is a rapper, historian, would you call him? Yeah. And I don't know, I would call him an intellect as well.
Intellectual,
right. If you don't know who he is, you should check Akala out. Yeah. But
I'd say he's a poet as well.
A poet, yeah. I would say he's a poet, yeah.
Yeah.
But he says that money is not wealth itself, but it is a means to get wealth. So money is not wealth, but it is a means to get wealth.
Yeah.
And we have to recognize that as a society, to understand that those that exist in parameters of not having it, then, you know, it does impact whether we like it or not. But capitalist society will tell you that the dream is that it's all down to you, and as long as you work completely hard, then you'll be fine, and there'll be no reason for you to be upset.
I only took 11 minutes for you to jump into capitalist society, and I'm surprised you haven't mentioned Boris Johnson yet, man. You've probably missed talking about him.
Well, it's your lead today, so
it is. And actually,
we'll
see
if I can shoehorn in.
Yeah, maybe you will. Maybe you will. So, if I said acceptable immigrant to you, what do you think I'm talking about?
Don't know. Genuinely, don't know. I've had a thought there, and I don't know.
Okay, if I said Emma Raducanu to you, would it make more sense?
No.
Okay, all right. So, do you know who Emma Raducanu is?
I feel like I should, but
okay.
I don't.
Well, she's the 18-year-old girl from
the tennis player.
Correct. Yeah.
Right, okay,
and she just won the US Open. This, you know, amazing like journey. I'll be one of the people, unlike loads of the people that came on social media the day after she won, and I say I wasn't really following her. And
did you not put a LinkedIn post up, mate, about
no, I didn't. No? I didn't. I feel really bad because I missed that opportunity.
There were so many great posts on LinkedIn. So many thoughtful.
Well, we'll come on to that. We might come on to that. But basically, I watched the final. I didn't really follow it. I'm not a huge, huge tennis fan. Not like all the people that post on LinkedIn the day after.
Massive fans of tennis. Followed their journey all the way. Yeah, all the way.
Yeah, exactly. But basically, incredible win, incredible journey. But then there's been a big conversation around British multiculturalism and heritage as a result, and it's really interesting to kind of see what's sort of being said. She's been hailed as a bastion of multiculturalism in Britain. Born in Toronto, came over here when she was very young to London. Her mum's Chinese, her dad's Romanian, and worked really hard. And obviously, worked really hard, and you get to win the US Open. Won $2.5 million, I think, and a championship. That seems like it's acceptable, immigration, work hard, do well, succeed. Mm. But often when Romanians are talked about, it's from a negative light. So why do you think that is? Why do you think we as a nation celebrate immigration sometimes, but not at other times? And I don't just mean the fringe right, by the way. I mean generally in society.
Well, look, firstly, despite all of the LinkedIn posts, and I'll be honest, I didn't really... I do have a little bit of a browse on social media on a Sunday morning sometimes, despite not browsing on social media anywhere near as much anymore, very purposefully. But I didn't this Sunday because it was all just posts about this Emma girl. And I didn't once see anything about her being an immigrant. I didn't even know she was. I just assumed that she was not an immigrant. So, but to your question, why do we celebrate it sometimes and why do we not? I think the way that we look at immigrants and immigration is predominantly a place to place people's anger and hatred and dark side. And they don't actually really know why they dislike immigrants or because I don't actually think that it's defied by any logic. It's somewhere to place your hate, your darker side, and some of your more difficult emotions, largely speaking. I think once upon a time it was largely more about homeless people and addicts and people like that. That's where a lot of it used to go. And then I think they started to find a little bit more compassion around that sense. And then it moved more towards immigration. So I don't know. Does that answer the question? Does that give you some kind of outlay of an answer?
I think the thing about... this isn't about making every single topic we talk about be about race. But I think it's really... it's stoked up an interesting conversation because, I hate holding up Nigel Farage as a person to kind of give any airtime to. But when he talked about when he was leader of UKIP, he talked about how he would not like a bunch of Romanian men, moving next door to him. And the implications of that were insidious. He wasn't explicit, but he was saying that that was going to be dangerous. It was going to be, there was going to be high levels of theft and all those sorts of, things. And then when Emma won, he tweeted about what an incredible, success story it is. And I think...
did he? Right.
Yeah. And I think what's interesting to me is also when, I think it was Raheem Sterling maybe said this, after the final, when you're winning, you're English, when you're losing, you're black.
Yeah.
And it just it's just a lens by which we look at success and what we view as, you know, an immigrant, you know, doing well, working hard versus the ones that sponge off society. And it's a fine line. And of course, you've got the ones like Nigel Farage who are just really happy to get column inches in the newspapers by really shouting about it. But then you've got a lot of people that, you know, we've talked about this sort of unconscious bias or hidden kind of xenophobia or racism, where that, you know, that actually they, even if they don't necessarily vocalize it publicly like some of these people, there's a feeling that, you know, that you view people that come in and work hard, do well, as successful, and the ones that don't aren't successful immigrants in your eyes. But we have to think about, you know, this notion of intersectionalism, that not every immigrant has the same opportunities. Not everyone has the same start. As you know, we don't all just come off the boat. And I can say that because my dad was an immigrant to the country. You don't just kind of all start at the same level. You have different levels of support from your country that you're leaving, your family. You may have a bit of income. You may have education. All those sorts of things. So not everybody gets the same opportunities. So we often look at immigration only for the, you know, we only celebrate it when we look at, you know, we look at it as success. So what was starting to happen was that, you know, publications, maybe The Guardian, was just sort of celebrating multiculturalism, and this is brilliant, showing that you can come from Canada, you can have a Chinese mum, a Romanian dad, and you can thrive in this country. And I don't think that's always the case.
Did The Sun or anyone like that then not print saying it's a disgrace that she's calling herself British?
I don't read The Sun, so I don't know. But I think I read somewhere that it has sparked a debate about whether she can call herself British. But I wonder if...
Oh, it has. So there has
but
been...
I wonder if that's just because she was born in Canada as opposed to like her sort of heritage mix.
Right. Similar to, by the way, Lennox Lewis. Lewis was born in Canada, wasn't he? But very much flew the British flag when he was boxing.
Yeah.
He's even got a bit of a Canadian accent, isn't he?
Yeah, I always struggle to get behind his accent.
Yeah.
But also you get a lot of footballers that cross nationalities, don't they?
Oh yeah. Wow, you've only got to look at Jack Grealish. Played most of his child career for
Republic of Ireland.
Was it Ireland? Yeah. I was gonna say Ireland
or
Wales.
Was it Northern Ireland?
Dunno. It wasn't England though. Yeah. But that happens a lot, and you see Zaha was gonna play for England, wasn't he? And then he's gone. I can't remember what his home country was, but he's gone there as well.
So, but sticking on Emma, she sort of also drew heat from some quarters during Wimbledon. I don't know if you remember this, but she withdrew from a match she was playing because she was having breathing difficulties, and the assumption is that the pressure. Or, you know, just the kind of the sheer mental load of having a nation following you and you being the hope was starting to affect her physically. Excuse me. And Piers Morgan, of all people, kind of came out really against her and said, you know, she doesn't have what it takes to be a champion and that she should listen to John McEnroe, who said some sort of stuff about, you know, the pressures of the game. And it just got me thinking about, you know, stress and pressure that we put on young people these days, and just sort of what do you think that Gen Z and millennials are feeling in terms of pressure today versus kind of what we used to face?
Look, firstly, obviously a lot of the people that exist in the sphere that I exist in, the echo chamber that I'm in online, this was the narrative, right? That she prioritised her mental health and then she came back and won the US Open because she did so. And I think there's a massive conversation to be had around that. Like, what I call resilience, by the way, is the ability to make sure that we know when to take our foot off the gas so that we can come back even stronger and better, right? That's resilience. So what she did in that sense actually feeds very much into what I said. I did think it was interesting. I was listening to the radio yesterday and Steve Bruce went on holiday during the international break, and he was just getting caned about it on the radio, right?
Yeah.
Getting caned for it because he'd taken time out. And I just thought it was interesting.
Steve Bruce.
Yeah. The manager of Newcastle, during the international break, he went on holiday. And I just thought it was interesting because I thought, well, he might have done it for his mental health as well, right? So it was. I just thought it was interesting that it was a different kind of narrative, right? And that he came back, by the way, and got beat 4-1 by Man United in his game. But surely we can't say that you're a mental health break, if that's what we're going to call it, or prioritising our mental health in the way that she's done. We can't only celebrate it if you come back and win, right? You can't go, well, you let yourself down because you took it off and then didn't come back and win, right? Because that ain't going to happen every time.
Yeah.
So there's that conversation to be had. But in terms of how do I think the pressure...
Or he might have just been having a holiday because he thought, well, I've got nothing else to do.
Well, he might have been, but so might have this Emma girl.
No, but I think she's been more open about...
She said it was prioritising her mental health, yeah. Steve Bruce said he felt like he needed to take some time out.
Fair enough.
Also, yeah. So there's no different. No. In my opinion, there's no different. And actually, I think we should give people more power to know when they need to take some time out.
Well, it's an interesting thing you sort of say, because I agree. We shouldn't be judging whether people are needing time off or not, or the reasons for it. Excuse me. I wanted to sort of look at some statistics around pressure and stress and anxiety. And Deloitte do an annual survey of millennials and Gen Z.
Yeah.
26%. So their study in 2021, 26% of millennials and 22% of Gen Z said that they have taken time off work for stress and anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
That's not surprising, is it? Really?
No.
However, 44% of those gave a different reason for being absent because of the stigma around mental health. So they might have said, oh, you know, mm-hmm. COVID, or might have said sore leg or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So it just shows that there is, and even just our conversation around why it's okay for maybe a younger person versus it maybe not for an older person, shows that there's still very much a stigma. Like, in a way, I have to say, even myself, I was going, oh, well, he's just, what was going on in my head was, he's just had the summer break, why does he need another break? But actually, yeah. The pressures of the game, when you're, particularly when you're a club like that, or his life, exactly, or whatever's going on, so many assumptions. But I immediately went, oh, well, you've sort of been there, you know how to, you should be able to handle it, you know?
Yeah.
So I have to check myself on that. Because I was already going, while you were talking, I was going into that space.
Yeah, yeah. And that's why I purposely brought him up, because I think he makes you think that. Now, there's a real complex and deep conversation to have around it, right? Because put yourself in a management role of an organization and a company, right? If you say you were the next bit up, right? You were part of the leadership team near the top of a big organization that I worked for. And you were trying to build me up to be the next thing, right? The next, you know, up next to you, by your side.
That sounds like quite a likely proposition. if we were in the corporate game, I'd definitely be the boss. You'd be my protege.
I probably wouldn't disagree with that. if things were getting tough, like they do in a working environment, we can't get away from that. And then I rang you up and said, on the day of a very important meeting, I ain't coming in today, mate, because I've got to look after my mental health and I don't feel great. I'll be back in tomorrow. It's not necessarily anything to do with stigma if you thought that does alter my views on whether he's ready for this, right? You wouldn't necessarily be driving stigma by altering your perception of me for that. You'd be a human being, right? So I think we have to be honest and realistic about that. Now that doesn't necessarily change the narrative. By the way, you know, if you ask me, do I think people should be able to be honest? I do. But I think we all have to be honest about this, the situation as well, because we can swing right the other way, right? And I think issues lie in that space too. One of the reasons, when you look at the high percentage of Gen Z and all that, being able to say that they've taken time off for their emotional state and their mental health or whatever, some of that is to do with how we have now given them a way to communicate their struggle.
Yeah.
And I've done a lot of reading recently on this. We think that if you look at, for example, the huge rise in cases of bulimia when Princess Diana came out and said she had bulimia, everybody goes, well, that's just because they all were existing somewhere in the shadows. And then her coming out and speaking about it meant that they could come out and talk about it. But actually, when you start to look at the data and you really look at studies, a lot of it says that actually in a lot of cases, not a small amount, I couldn't tell you the facts and figures from it, but a lot of them were new to bulimia because Princess Diana came out and talked about it, and it gave them a way to be able to communicate their own distress. So there's a there is a fine line in that. Do you understand what I'm saying with that?
Yeah. So it's almost that you know they saw Princess Diana's situation, the way she communicated it, and sort of it resonated for them, and therefore you know it became
a way of them communicating. Distress. And so if we push the mental health day, right, taking time off for your mental health, if we push it too much, if I look at what I've been able to achieve over the last 3 or 4 years, I had to go to some quite uncomfortable places to be able to do what I'm doing. So I need to make sure that I have enough self-understanding to know when I'm feeling uncomfortable and when I'm feeling it, because, you know, we talk about that. If you want to go anywhere, you need to go into the uncomfortable. You need to go out of your comfort zone, right? Yeah. And I do have, and I think there should be a genuine concern about, if we push that narrative too much, then people won't push themselves into that. They won't be able to, you know, get to the high levels that maybe they do want to achieve if they're not careful. Now, this Emma, I keep forgetting her surname. I'm just not a tennis fan, so I haven't really paid attention to what she's doing. But she's a prime example of how, if you do it and you do it right, you can get huge success. But I do think we have to make sure that we have the balanced conversation around it.
You know, the other thing to say about it is it could have simply been a physical thing that we have just, as a nation, made an assumption about in terms of Wimbledon. It could have been that
she's never come out and said that it was...
No. Okay. It was just breathing difficulties. And there's been loads of assumptions about the fact that it was you know, to do with...
anxiety, overwhelm, anxiety. Or whatever,
So we don't know that, you know, that led to her. She's a very talented tennis player. She's probably was going to win anyway, you know. But, you know, just to kind of pick up on your point about, you know, if you'd have called me on the day of the big presentation and said, I'm not coming in, I'm going to prioritise my mental health. I will say, in that situation, you know, given the way that I used to kind of be a boss, I hope, is I would be annoyed at you because that's just, you know, part one is just, you know, just being annoyed. But I think what the reason I'm saying that is, I don't think it should be a surprise to me if you are feeling anxious, and that you create the, you know, it's really important to create conditions where you can be open with each other. And it's really important that you can, you know, not everyone is willing and ready to talk about stuff that's going on internally. But I know that the way that I used to try and be as a boss was to be open, be supportive. But even in that moment, I don't imagine you would say it like in a the way you said it was quite blasé, like I'm just not coming in, it's, you know. But I think that our relationship, because we have a strong psychological contract, you would understand, even though you were going to step away, you would understand the impact that would have on us, on our team, on what we were supposed to do that day. And I think it would be delivered slightly differently, and therefore I wouldn't be pissed off because it wouldn't have been delivered in that way. We would have just found a way forward.
Yeah. I think when we use me as an example, it gives a different and another context as well, though, right? Because we know each other very well. We know each other inside out, and you kind of know, you know, me, that if I said to you, I can't come because I'm struggling internally, you would know that shit's gone down and I'm really struggling, right? And I'm not saying that wouldn't be true if anybody else says it, but I am having, genuinely, in the work that I do, more and more conversations with leadership people who are saying to me, I'll be in a meeting and somebody will start saying, I can't talk about this, it's triggering me. And I've had leaders say to me, we're not talking about anything like out there. We're just trying to push people because our job is quite high stress. That's what it is, right? It's quite high stakes and all that sort of stuff. And so there's concerns from the leadership's teams around this kind of stuff. And I think it's a valuable and genuine concern. And what we have to do is make sure that we don't create that conversation like we seem to do at the moment with every conversation, where we just shut down every other narrative and we go, if you don't think it's okay for somebody to say that they're having a mental health problem, then you're stigmatizing mental health, right? Which is not, yeah. I know that's not what you were saying, but if we don't have balanced conversation, what happens is the leadership people that I'm talking about, yeah, that have those genuine and valid concerns, they'll stop having the conversations within their organizations because it's not worth their while, or because it starts getting too difficult and they feel like they're the ones being silenced.
The thing that's interesting about this space, because I agree to some extent that it can start to, the line between sort of truth and what isn't can get a bit blurred.
Mm.
And a lot of assumption gets built into that. And also sometimes you start to think, you start to question the sincerity of what that person's feeling. But it's complex because they might actually genuinely think that they're feeling that. And that's sort of something to kind of look at. So I think the thing we need to look at is, up until this point, has it always been wrong? Has it always been there and it just hasn't been surfaced? Has mental health been really, 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 detrimentally suffering, but we've just never talked about it because that's just not how it was done? And whereas now the doors are open. And let me just ask you to look at it from a different lens. We've opened up the conversation around race and bias. And when people veer into the territory of being, of bringing unconscious bias, or if they're saying something inappropriate, and obviously people, organizations, leaders are much more conscious to the fact of what is appropriate and what isn't appropriate in terms of language. Sure, even though, even though some of the conversations may not feel like it is something that is, someone's being triggered or someone feels like they're being kind of marginalized. Who draws the line about what's being felt by that person or not? And why is it different for race and why is it different for mental health?
Okay, so to bring it quickly back to the first bit that you said, I'm actually, the point I'm making is not that I think that people will start using it as a lie and a reason not to be able to come to work. I think there will always be people that do that, and they don't need mental health to do that. They can just say a headache, right? Or a backache. Yeah, they can use an invisible physical thing. So those people exist. I think they're a small minority. I am actually talking more about the people that, once we start to give them a way to communicate their distress, that they will then actually subconsciously, my worry is that subconsciously then we all start to think every time that we feel something difficult, then we should completely come back, we should peel away from it and take some time off. And actually, I think to be successful in anything that you do need to push yourself. I always think, I use this as an analogy in a lot of the work that I do. I use the rev counter on a car. Sometimes you've got to go up in the red to get back into your safety position on the road. Just don't spend if you're in that red all of the time, then you've got to take your foot off it, or you're going to blow the engine up. Mm. But sometimes you have to go up into it, flick into it, right? That's And that's true, I think, in the ways in which we approach our emotions and stuff. It's more about, I worry that we're going to start telling people that if you ever go in the red at all, take a day off. And yeah. then actually you're not going to get to where you need to go in life.
You're not doing the work personally.
Yeah.
Because I think other people can't do the work that you need to do to figure out what your kind of how you, what your coping mechanisms are, what your management systems are internally for when you get triggered or for when you're feeling like you're, you know, struggling.
Yeah.
So I think that's absolutely right. Because if we suddenly say, it's a bit like a doctor before you even go in, you just kind of go, oh, you know, I'm not feeling great. And he'll go, right, here's
yeah.
you know, 7 days of antibiotics. And you're like, well, I don't yeah. know. Like, well, maybe I don't need that.
That's exactly it, right? That's exactly what I'm talking about. And then we make every difficult emotion terrifying and something that we need to take a break from. And actually, if we can lean into our, what am I feeling on that morning of that meeting when I think I need to take a mental health break, right? Do I really need to do that? Or do I need to lean into what I'm feeling? Does this mean a lot to me? Is my body trying to get me into a state where it wants me to be high alert and ready to go into the meeting, right? That comes with, you know, that's about self-awareness and all of that stuff. And again, let me highlight, the answer in that situation might be that you need to take a foot off, right? It's just we need to, if we're going to go down that route, we need to make sure that we're educating one another on our feelings and our full range of emotions. You can do that by getting Josh Connolly into your organisation and running a proper resilience workshop if you want.
I couldn't believe that you just used
it. That was a joke. Let me come to the race thing. You talked about triggers and races and why is it different. I'll tell you why. Triggers are my responsibility. Race isn't. Yeah? So it's not your responsibility to navigate the world in the way that you shouldn't go, I've got brown skin, so I have to deal with that. And if that means that, you know, I have to walk slightly wide berth of people, I don't know, I'm trying to make things up as yeah. I go. That's not your responsibility.
Yeah.
That's not. If my behavior triggers you, that's your responsibility. Unless, you know, if I'm being hateful and all that kind of stuff and I'm acting outside of the rules of our society, yeah? So if I was being racist to you, for example, then that's not your responsibility. But if my behaviour, if you're triggered, the trigger is a signal to the part of you that needs work. It is not a signal for you to tell me to change my behaviour. And the latter is what we're starting to do more and more of. Most people that need any kind of healing work do so because they grew up in an environment where they were walking on eggshells, right? Trying not to set off their parent in their dysfunctional family environment, right? That's because their parent believed that everybody around them should change their behavior as to not trigger them. If we start making your triggers my responsibility, then we've got a problem. And we're doing that already, by the way, and we have a problem. Because everybody's running around now instead of looking at why their what part of their wounding is going on here, why am I so triggered by that behavior? They're running around telling everyone that they should stop their behavior, and it's a yeah. problem. That's yeah. dysfunction. That's very dysfunctional.
Yeah. Yeah, we haven't got time to go into this week, but I'd like to revisit again. But there was a case rumbling on in the advertising industry about some white male creative directors that were made redundant, and it followed, you know, some conversation. It was followed a speech by a senior female creative who said, "We need something along the lines of we need to blow up this whole kind of male dominated environment." That was one comment, but it was really around kind of we need to kind of, you know, build inclusion. But they then countersued to say that they were discriminated against for being, and they won. They won the case. So it's a really interesting topic around what that says around how people view being triggered and kind of, you know, and what implications something like that has. But just going back to that Deloitte study, this was a really interesting one. So obviously millennials and Gen Z were surveyed. I think it was something like over 20,000 people. So it was a big survey globally. so this is global as well, it's not just kind of UK based, half of those surveyed, so 50%, said that they feel stressed all or most of the time. It's not just even about work, it's just constantly carrying it around of you. And I don't think that's just millennials. You know, in the last 19, 20 months, I don't think that's just millennials. But this is the survey. So do you think that's real? Do you think that's genuine?
I do think it's real. And I think one, there's a whole conversation to be had around how we can become addicted to the stress hormone, right? And how actually
cortisol, is it?
Yeah, can take us away from our... can take us away from ourselves, and so our inability to be with ourselves makes us get stressed, addicted to it. But I think when you look at the devices that we carry around with us all of the time now, and the way in which we're fed news and videos and all that kind of stuff all of the time with the algorithms and all of that, I made a very conscious effort over the last few months to stop scrolling, and I have done very well at doing so. And to stop going on the news, because if you pick up a news app now, they don't, you know, it's an age old conversation, but they don't like, good news doesn't get clicks. So it's all just stuff on there, just, you know, to drag you down. I see Paul Merson. He was on GMTV this morning. Good Morning Britain this morning. He's been clean from addiction for a while, but he went back in lockdown.
And
one of the things was, he said, I'm an addict. He said, so I kept watching the news, and I was watching news all of the time. And he said, and my mind just kept, he's going, this is really bad. It's never going to get better. And I like really related to what he was saying. Like, I was watching it. If you listen to some of our episodes in the kind of last few months or the last few weeks of when we was recording last time, I was really wrapped up in just watching it all of the time. And I was keeping up with it all. And I was in a stressed state all of the time. And a big part of it was I see on my device.
I remember, actually, because I think we talked about it really early on, maybe 5 or 6 episodes in, and you asked me how I'm feeling. And I was like, I'm pretty ambivalent. It's because I stopped watching the daily news.
Yeah.
I stopped charting the highs and the lows and the, you know, the highs of, you know, the cases and all that sort of stuff. So I think there's something in it. But also, you're right, like the newspaper, and we all probably select a certain, you know, a certain kind of medium of, you know, communication. I'm left leaning, obviously. There's no surprise about that. So I don't go anywhere. When you ask me about the Sun or the Daily Mail, I have no idea, because I don't go anywhere near it. And so I'm also just feeding myself with one particular narrative as well. And it is, you know, it's fed to you in a particular way. Like with a newspaper, old school print, you just like, you go to the areas that are interesting, whereas you don't really have the choice, because you have to scan and you get pulled in a way, and it's fed to you in a particular way, right?
And then not to mention the way that you're always connected to everybody all of the time, right? When I was a kid, if I wanted to get hold of Hass, I would have to ring the house phone, right? Mm-hmm. And then you go... Hi, it's Hass home. And then what you normally get is, yeah, hang on. Hass! Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But if you weren't there, I didn't get hold of you, and then I watched the telly or whatever. So even if you have a nice functional home at the moment, home environment, right?
Yeah.
A lot of these young people are sat. I mean, I look at my teenage daughter who lives with me. She is in constant conversation, not just with one other person, but massive groups of people across different platforms.
Yeah.
All of the time. Yeah. Right? And so there's no rest, there's no let up, right? If there's a little bit of drama in so-and-so's life over there, it's in the group and everyone's talking about it, and you're in stressed, worried about it all of the time, you know? So there's no let up with that.
It's really interesting that you say that, because I was reading about this, but also my daughter's a little bit younger. My eldest daughter's a little bit younger, but they don't use phones anymore to basically communicate. It might be very, very brief. Like, are you in town? Yeah. No. That's it. Off. And like, there's no sort of, hey, how you doing, and conversation. Nope. And so all of it is in groups and chats, and, you know, and messages. And there was a study done by a guy called Alfred Morabian in the 60, so it's out of date. And you know, but he said that he found that words counted for only 7% of communication. The rest was tone and body language.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Whereas where the 100% of the means of communication is words. That's why it's so much, it carries so much when somebody just does a dry text.
Yeah.
That's what they, you know, what they say, which means there's no emotion attached to it. There's no kiss at the end of it. That sends them down like, oh, what? Like they start going, oh, what have I done wrong? Are you mad at me? Yeah. And actually it was like, no, I was just saying, I'll see you in town.
Yeah,
you
know? Yeah.
And then, so actually it's, that whole kind of method of communication needs to evolve, or how we operate as humans needs to evolve, which is why, like, my kids, they laugh at some of the emojis that we use as at our age, because it's very, very different, because their method of communication is very different. And we probably overdo it on being affectionate.
Yeah, no, it's funny, isn't it? It's funny that it's now which emoji you're using, not the fact that emojis are even being used. But I mean, like my teenage kids, they don't really even use text anymore, though. It's all voice note. Or they take like a really close-up picture of their face and then write their response over that. And yet, see, like my eldest, she'd kill me if she heard this. But I had to take her in and get her bus pass.
She's never going to listen to it anyway. So I
she's not an avid 150 miles podcast listener. But I had to take her in to get a bus pass the other week, and I had to take her photo, and she was it crippled her that she had to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, you take 100 pictures a minute of yourself on that phone to send to your mates to give them a message.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you are, she's cripplingly shy in general, my daughter. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, to bring it kind of right back to the topic of the conversation that you're talking about, it makes total sense to me that they're stressed more often, because me and you, one of the things we talk a lot about, like now, and there's a measured difference in both of us now in our communication on the weekend. Like on the weekend, I all but don't touch my phone.
Mm.
Unless I need to, it's left alone. It's not in my pocket. It's not with me. I'll go and check it. And if I've got a message, I might reply to it or whatever. But even if it's not that important, I'll leave it. And
usually just get gifts from me, don't you, at the moment? The weekend or WhatsApp.
Yeah. Mainly because you're doing all right at Fantasy League after 3 games, which is good for you.
But where are you? You're languishing second from bottom, aren't you, Josh?
Yeah, or because like I said, I'm not giving it the energy anymore. I'm living a better life.
Yeah. Drinking your espressos.
Less online time, more espresso. Yeah, more espresso pods and avocado on toast for me, mate.
Good life. what a wonderful conversation to kick off season 2, Josh. It's been a really, really missed part of my routine. So I'm delighted that we're back into it. And in fact, I'm going to just jump straight in with reasons to be cheerful.
All right, before you do, if your reasons to be cheerful is that 115 miles is back, yeah, that's a fucking cop out.
Yeah.
Right? And you should be fined. We should, do you know what we should do? We should start a charity fine system this season.
Okay.
Where we randomly fine each other.
Okay.
£5.
Okay, so my reason to be cheerful this week, Josh, is...
You're just crossing out.
The new charity fine system that we've created for 115 miles for when we get something wrong or when we mess up. So you're going to be putting loads of money in there. Now, honestly, I know it feels like a cop-out, my reason to be cheerful... is this, it's getting back and doing this, because not only do I enjoy having this conversation, and I think other people, you know, have commented that, you know, it brings some value to them, but actually it makes me think about things in a different way. And also I know I'm going for at least an hour or so every couple of weeks, you're going to keep me on my toes, and we're going to have, you know, talks about some important stuff. So I think intellectually, it's really important, and I have really enjoyed it today.
Good. And it's good to be back, mate. It's good to be back. Really enjoyed it. My reasons to be cheerful is this. The fact that 115... It's not. I'm joking. I got a bit more about me. My reasons to be cheerful is my older brother being alive. I'll very quickly tell a story. Last week, I woke up on Tuesday to a text message saying that my older brother, who I'm very close with, had a bleed on his brain. He was rushed to hospital, rushed to John Radcliffe Hospital in Oxford. And literally, like, the type of thing that he had, that not many people survive it. And I was there Tuesday morning. I text my brother's phone saying, "I love you, bro." And I was looking at this message thinking he might never read it. That's where it was. Fortunately, he had a load of tests done. And essentially, when you get this thing that he had, 85% of people either die or have lifelong, life-changing, you know, reactions to it. My brother has fell into the 15%, which means he basically will go back to living life exactly as he did before. Can play football, can carry on riding his bike, all of that. So, incredible. He just had some tests done yesterday. It was a week ago. So he's been in hospital 7 days now. They are going to keep him in for another 7 days. His brain is just clearing the blood that was left on his brain, and it works really hard and makes him really poorly. But he's going to be all right, essentially, unless something drastic was to happen. But they don't foresee that at all. So yeah, incredible, really, to go through such a roller coaster and him just come out the other side and he's going to be all right. And I tell you what, actually, the real reasons to be cheerful is I was thinking to myself when he might have been gone, I couldn't have done anything more with my brother. We speak on the phone for like an hour once a week, at least, as well as texting all of the time. So, you know, it wouldn't have been one of them. I should have spent more time with him. We go out on our bike all the time together. You know, we're doing life together as we should be. So I guess the reasons to be cheerful is the relationship with my brother and the fact that it's still there.
Man, if there was ever a reason to validate why we do reasons to be cheerful, that's it.
Yeah, no, it is, mate. It is, yeah, massive.
And what I take from that is, you know, you're saying there's, you know, you really value the time you spend with your brother. But for me, I think there's also a reminder that you got to live in the moment.
Mm.
And I often put myself in that space of always prepping for the future. If I just do this, or if I just do that, we'll be in a better position, or we'll just, you know, and actually you can't put off happiness to the future or being present to the future. You can't like go, you know, in a year's time, that's when I'll have more space and time to be with the kids or with my family. Mm. Because that day may never come.
100%, yeah.
Right? So you just got to go for it. So that is an incredible... I'm very glad that I knew you were going to kind of bring that today as reasons to be cheerful. That's why I purposefully downplayed mine, just so you can have the spotlight.
You're so full of shit.
Mate. mate, it's good to be back.
It is, mate. And to the listeners, it's good to
be back.
See you next time. See you next time. See you next time. Thanks again for listening to 115 Miles with Josh Connolly and Hassan Kyle.